Welcome to Modern Signed Books. If you're interested in what makes your favorite authors tick, then you'll love hearing what they have to say in our interviews. Learn how they got started writing, the books and authors that inspired them, and much more. Meet today's hottest authors as they discuss their lives and writing with art book specialist, Roger Nichols. And don't forget to pick up a copy of your favorite books at vjbooks.com. Here's Roger.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. It takes a special kind of both dedication and creativity to work in and wildly succeed at three different branches of writing. Unfortunately, our guest this morning has it all and more. Carl Hyacin has nailed the trifecta of journalist, columnist, and novelist. For 41 years, he has worked for one of the outstanding newspapers in the country, the Miami Herald, as a journalist and as a columnist. In 1981, he published the first of three novels co-written with friend and fellow journalist William Montalbano. He soloed in 1986 with Tourist Season, and since then has been a regular on top of the New York Times best-selling list. In addition, the Ginsu Knives, and he's written three songs with the late Warren Zevon, and one of his characters memorialized in a song by Jimmy Buffett, picked up a Newbery Medal for his first YA novel, Hoot, had his columns published in three different collections, and is credited with bringing the children's fancy Aragon to his editors. His work has been translated into 34 languages, and his latest, Razor Girl, is now out in mass market edition. We're very pleased to welcome Carl Hyacin. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, what a delight. Now, the ever-reliable Wikipedia says you started writing at age six when your father brought you a typewriter for Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, I also got, the usual bike and baseball mitt, but I did ask my dad for a little portable typewriter, and he showed great amusement, but went and got it for me anyway. So, I started sort of pecking on the typewriter when I was young. I was lucky. I was one of these folks and kind of knew what they wanted to do at a young age, but that's ridiculous, a young age, but they indulged me.
Well, and that didn't stop you at all. You went on, as I understand it, from one of your interviews, to do an underground newspaper at your high school called More Trash.
I did. Yeah, I did. In high school, I did a sort of an underground newspaper. And then in college, I started writing columns. You know, I started doing, you know, because this was the age of Nixon when I was in college, there was material was incredible, and
yeah.
So I started doing sort of satirical political columns in college, and then went on and got newspaper jobs and did real journalism for a while after that.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Now you've done investigative journalism. You worked at the City Desk. How did that shift to column? Where did that happen? I mean, later on, but you didn't start that way.
It was funny, Roger. I just started working on the first novel that I did by myself called Tourist Season, and sort of the hero or anti-hero of that novel was a crazed Florida newspaper columnist who sort of goes around the bend. He sort of goes crazy because he's environmentally conscious and the whole state is turning to concrete, and he forms this little band of eco-terrorists. And I was working on that novel, and my editor, I'd finished up a big investigation project. The editor said, you know, you always said you wanted to write a column. You want to start writing a column now. And I said, well, I'd love to start writing a column, but I need you to know that I'm working on this book in which the hero is a crazy columnist, and people are going to say, that's me. And he said, oh, go ahead. Don't worry about it. I'm sure he thought the book would never be published. So the crazy columnist, in fact, the one that Jimmy Buffett wrote the song about, Skip Wiley, existed on paper before I existed in reality as a columnist, but people think it was the other way around. But there was around 84, something like that, 1984.
And been doing it ever since. And
ever since, yeah.
And I think holding the feet to the fire of the people in the legislatures at various levels and for to good. I think one of the things that, having been a former editor for a small daily newspaper, I understand that our motto is we need to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable.
Well, of course. I mean, the whole point of being in journalism is you're giving information to people who need it if you want democracy to work, voters who need information, not just about politicians, but policy and social issues and all that kind of thing. And then for a columnist, your job is to raise hell.
Yeah.
And kick some ass. And you know, they don't pay you to write about funny things that your dog did today. They pay for you put your opinion. I always love it when you get letters saying that that's not a very objective column. They don't pay me to be objective. They pay me for an opinion. Yeah. And people are under the illusion that columns are supposed to be neutral. That's not a column. That's a letter to your mom. You know, I mean, it's just completely different. So yeah, it has to have a hard edge. In the world we live in, the politics we're going through right now, you have to be, you know, somewhat on the ball.
Yeah. Hey, well, yeah, and I think one of the things you have been able to do over the years is to present exaggerated versions, comically exaggerated versions of characters that you see in all the different aspects of it, and make us aware by a bit of exaggeration just how crazy things are out there.
Well, that's sort of the objective of satire. You know, the novels I write are supposed to be funny, and I want them to be funny, but I want people to be laughing for the right reasons. You know, satire has a target. It has an objective, and it's supposed to make you look at parts of society in a certain, hold them up to ridicule and mockery when they deserve it. You know, in Razor Girl, there's a character who's the star of one of these redneck reality TV shows. He's not a real redneck, but he was cast for the part, and they brought someone in to give him a Cajun accent and everything. But the artificiality of it and sort of America's fascination with that culture, which is, from being from the South myself, I'm amused by the whole thing. But when I was writing it, I had no idea that I would turn on the television in a few months and there would be a guy from Duck Dynasty addressing the Republican National Convention last July. I would never have even thought of that for one of my books. I thought nobody's going to believe that nonsense. Nobody would ever believe that if I made my character in this book do that. And sure enough, it happened.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's amazing. I suppose we should talk a little bit about the book. That's kind of what we're here, but I want to visit some larger issues as well. But you have multiple protagonists, actually, in a sense, because you have a pretty good-sized cast of characters and switch some action from one to the next and tell you to mix them all together.
Yeah, either that looks like some sort of literary genius on my part or utter disorganization. But sometimes the characters, this book starts out with this crazy car accident that was based on something that really, really happened out in the Florida Keys. And I had been fiddling around with trying to get it into a novel for years. And so the driver of the car is a woman, and she's doing a little bit of personal grooming when she crashes into another car, you know, shaving while driving, if you can imagine. And it really happened. And in the original, my conception of the book, that character, Mary Mansfield, was going to be around for a while, but she wasn't going to really be the center of the book. She was hired to crash into somebody who was being pursued by the mob, and that was going to kind of be it. But she's one of those characters who just took the reins of the plot away from me, and I liked her so much. And so she started steering the book for a while. And the real hero of the book is an ex-cop who's now a restaurant inspector, busted down to Roach Patrol. And he was from a previous novel called Bad Monkey. And he's also, like you mentioned, one of the other protagonists. But now he's got to share the stage with her. And sometimes that happens. You know, you get a character that surprises you in a pleasant way. Part of the fun of these novels is you can just sort of sit back and follow the character sometimes yourself. I don't work from an outline. It's like wearing handcuffs to me to be working off an outline, and I don't do it. And sometimes at my own peril, I admit, it gets a little hectic.
But that's the fun part of it. The fact that you gradually raise the stakes by getting a little farther and farther and farther into the ridiculous situation. It's like getting into the hot water tub, inching in so you feel comfortable with it, and then suddenly you realize that you're in boiling water. This thing is going crazy, and you're having fun with it. So there's a lot of lovely, nifty details. Your protagonist, Buck Nance, the star of the Bayou Brethren, is actually from up north. I can't remember, Minnesota, Wisconsin, someplace like that.
And he's from Wisconsin. He knows nothing about Louisiana.
Right.
He looked the part. He had the right kind of beard, so they hired him for the role.
Yeah, they were in this accordion band, Grand Funk Romberg, which is their last name, and somehow grew beards to do a ZZ Top segment and then endeared them to the producers. And there's a lovely detail where you said that they liked everything about them except for their front teeth, so they sent them to an orthodontist to have them blackened and chipped. And that's just
that's right.
That's magic to me.
This is Hollywood, Roger. I mean, this stuff, I know it sounds nuts, but stuff like that happens. I mean, I can't overestimate the phoniness of some of these shows. So I just started to have fun with it. And I wanted to put three guys in this situation that were supposed to be these Louisiana chicken farmers. And they're all making a ton of money. And it's really a show business enterprise for them. But they've adopted this sort of, you know, right of the right politics, you know, to say the proper things and wave the Confederate flag as they would be expected to do on mm-hmm. in that role. And it gets them in all kinds of trouble, and it's just those are fun characters to put on stage, you know. And like Razor Girl with all the other books, I sort of sat down with a cast in mind of characters. I wanted a guy who sells beach sand because it's a big enterprise in Florida, selling beach sand because we have such erosion problems, and nature has no respect for commerce here, so they truck in millions of dollars worth of sand or bring it in by barge from the Bahamas to try to replace the beaches as they disappear. And then next summer, they got to do the whole thing all over again. It's a great business to be in. So I wanted a guy with a business called Sedimental Journeys.
Yes.
So I created one of those guys. And it's not too far from the reality of what happens down here.
Yeah,
it's fun when you get sort of these the motley crew together.
Well, and the setup, it works in, without giving away a lot of the plot, but this happens very early on, is that this lady on purpose crashes into the car because she has been hired by the mob to kidnap the guy who has the beach sand business because he apparently dumped a bunch of foot lacerating crud on the beach in front of the hotel owned by the mob. And he happens to be driving the same car as the one that the guy that they're after.
Right.
Yes. And from then on, hilarity ensues in multiple ways. So.
She actually runs into the wrong car, and the beach guy it was not in the car. But yeah, he's being pursued because he sold the mob some bad beach, really bad guy, and it's so bad that the people coming to the mob's resort, and they have several nice properties in Florida. The mob's customers are rushing into the lobby with lacerated feet from the bad granular composition of the fake beach. So they're chasing this guy. They want their money back, and he's in trouble. And then Mary Mansfield, who is, you know, the eponymous Razor Girl, she gets swept up in that because she's accidentally, you know, hit the wrong car. So that's kind of the setup. That's kind of how it gets launched.
Right, and as a lovely little side part to it, the guy who they get is like the handler for this Nance character who is supposed to make an appearance at a local nightclub, and it goes horribly awry.
Well, somebody, the ratings for the reality show Bayou Brethren are strong everywhere in the country, but in certain demographics like Key West, Florida, where the politics are kind of free and easy and liberal, so they decide to... They're going to send Buck to Key West to do a little stand-up comedy routine and hopefully get more interest in the show. And his brand of humor does not go over well in Key West. He has a number of inappropriate jokes that no one has warned him not to say to a Key West audience. And so he basically has to run for his life and disappears in the town of Key West. Now, Key West is a very small island, but if you've ever been there, it's a very easy place to get lost in many ways. And Buck gets lost in all those ways.
It is. I have to tell you that there are times when I just literally put the book down and laughed out loud. I think one of the ones when you described the Dominic Big Nugiola of the Calzone crime family. Just for some reason.
Yeah, the Calzone crime.
I don't know.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, being one of the benefits of a journalism background that you do, you get to meet good guys and bad guys over the years. And I haven't done any investigative reporting for many years, but I did for a while, and I certainly met my share of criminals and dope dealers and guys in prison that you're interviewing. And what you find out about it is that even bad guys have soft side or soft aspect to them, you know. And I mean, they're not cardboard Hollywood. They're not all good and they're not all bad.
Right.
But you, I mean, some of them have done very bad things, but they can sit there, be talking to you about their pet cat and have like tears in their eyes. Mm-hmm. And they hear they just maybe stab some guy 70 times. But if you bring up their little kitty cat, they're like children. And so the trick to make characters work is to make them human and real and not, mm-hmm. not something out of Hollywood casting, because that isn't real life. These are some of them complex people. They don't have the same set of moral codes that we're used to.
Yeah.
But they do have a code, and Dominic, the mob guy in the book, he does. He does believe in some things.
Yeah.
And you know, there is a human side to him, despite the cold-blooded side as well.
Yeah. You say told one interviewer that some days you need to be angry to be funny. I find that an interesting connection.
I think with satire, it's very true. I think that if you go back in history and look at satirical writing, whether it's Mark Twain or John Swift, I'm not putting myself in any of those categories, but there, I think the funniest stuff comes from a sense of anger about some injustice, something wrong with society or the world, or something that needs to be made fun of. I think you have to be a little bit pissed off about it to write about it. I mean, I write about Florida because it's where I was born and raised, and I care about the place. And infuriates me on some days what's happening down here. So a lot of the energy for the writing, for the humor, comes from that. And I think if you talk to other people who do this kind of thing, I think they'll tell you the same thing. I mean, even Dave Barry, one of the funniest guys in the world, is a very serious sort of social thinker about things, and a lot of what he writes has a pretty sharp point to it. And I do think you need that kind of edge when you're writing satire.
Yeah, and it strikes me, just as you mentioned Dave Barry, of course, and you've toured with him, and that's going to be a fantastic tour. People must have a great time with that. But I'm thinking also of John D. McDonald, whose Travis McGee series is set in Fort Lauderdale and aboard the Busted Flush, and who also wrote strongly about the environmental dangers in South Florida particularly.
He was one of the first, Roger, and one of my heroes. I never got to meet him. We exchanged notes about one of my books. He was very generous. He said nice things about tour season. And then before I could meet him, he had passed away. But he was the one. I was reading these old Travis McGee books, you know, and he would go off on these riffs about greedy developers and pollution and overpopulation, just in the course of dialogue, and he would slip all this stuff into these novels, and you were turning the pages so fast because of the story. But I thought, this guy is really clever, because he's getting his points in. He's getting a little ranting in here. And he still makes the plot work, and he still makes the characters work. And he was one of the first, and I think everybody who writes in Florida owes a great debt to John D. McDonald.
Yeah, I'm a huge, longtime, lifetime fan. I have every book that I've ever been able to get from him. So, and of course, love Travis McGee and the amazing Meyer. I want to know.
Yeah, Meyer was just a wonderful philosopher. Yeah, I mean, John was in many ways ahead of his time, and very prolific, but. But I grew up in Lauderdale, so I would go down to Bahia Mar and look for
slip F-19.
You know?
Yeah,
the slip at Bahia Mar where the houseboat was. I mean, that was I knew all those streets that he was writing about. It was a great. He was just a great person to sort of get the feel for how to do this.
Right, and I think without doubt I would say you have carried on that legacy. Perfectly, or in a different direction, but with the same quality of writing. So there's you can put that one on your next book up.
Well, there's no higher form of flattery than that. Thank you.
You betcha. What do you hope that people gain when they close the book at the end?
Well, you know, I always say that the greatest thrill is for people to laugh when they read the books, and I've had the honor of sitting in airports and watching it from a distance to somebody reading my book, and I've got my heart in my throat because I thought, I hope if they're not laughing, I'm not doing my job. And luckily, I get to see them smile or laugh while they're reading. And that, to me, was always the biggest reward, because it meant, first of all, they got what I was doing, and it was funny. But right now, in particular, in the time we're living in, I mean, I think people are desperate for laughter. It's necessary. You have to have it. It's a survival mechanism. So, you know, I want the books to be funny. Our job as writers, I don't care what kind of novel you write, the job is to entertain. That's your job. It's that simple. You got to keep people turning the pages. You got to, if you can't do that, you're not doing your job. And so that's the idea, is that they put the book down with a smile on their face and had a good time. And that maybe for a little while after that, the characters and the themes stay with them a little bit. But, you know, you're not changing the world. But if you can brighten the world sort of one laugh at a time, that's a pretty good gig, too.
And I think you're a perfect at it. I want to thank you so much for spending time with us. Our guest this morning, the amazing Carl Hiaasen, his latest out in the mass market paperback right now is Razor Girl. Highly recommended. Thanks again so much.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's great fun.
If you enjoyed this interview with Carl Hiaasen, we'd like to remind you that signed first edition copies of Razor Girl and other works by Carl Hiaasen available at VJ Books.
Thank you for listening to Modern Sign Books. Make sure to follow and comment on who you would like to hear next. Feel free to check out our other author interviews. And visit vjbooks.com to pick up